It's great to come to such a positive place and such a sport-mad place as Australia. And I've been here actually quite a few times. I think it's about 5 or 6 times. And I count it a privilege. And James, I saw you here. Where are you? Yeah, thank you for the trust. Malcolm, thank you for the trust. I never take that lightly, actually. I've been involved in a church for quite a long time and always count it a privilege to be involved and to have the opportunity to speak. And so I'd like this weekend to be helpful to you. Just want to give you a little bit. Do we go onto my slides now? So I come from a place, and this is my family. So give you a bit of my background. I hope you're going to find out a bit about you guys here. So I'm the good-looking one on the end, and which you obviously noticed. And then on the left-hand side is Yasmin. That's my 20-year-old daughter. Next to her is my 17-year-old daughter, Isabel. Next to her is my drop-deck gorgeous childhood sweetheart wife, who's still pretty bad eyesight, so I'm still doing good. And then next to her is my son, Jake, who's 23. So that's my family. And we live in West London, quite near Twickenham, which is where the Rugby World Cup final is. So I'm moving on. I've moved on from that. So that's my family. And I come to you. I've done 3 careers. I'm 52 years of age. I know I look a lot younger than that. Thanks for saying that. But I'm 52, and I've done 3 jobs in my life. I was a policeman for quite a long time in London. My mum tells me as a little boy, all I ever wanted to do was be a policeman. So I did that, and I went straight into that from school. And in the 1980s, which is when I was a policeman, there was lots of problems, industrial problems. So we had things like the miners' strike, we had lots of race riots. So my job for most of my police career, I was what they call a riot squad policeman, which basically meant we drove from fight to fight to fight to fight, having fights. And actually, people tend to think if there's a big fight, call the police. But normally what happens is when there's a big fight happening and the police turn up, the fight just gets bigger. It doesn't actually stop. So I spent a lot of my time doing that. And in the middle of my police career, that's when I had the great privilege and joy of actually coming to know Jesus personally, which was in 1983. So that's what I did. And then I worked for the Salvos. I got very excited about talking to people about Jesus. And I confess to you, I was a bit of a nightmare new Christian. A bit of a nightmare new Christian. I was so excited about this story, and I wanted to tell everybody. And people used to beg not to be put on night duty with me. Because, like, you're in a car with a bloke who's a nutty new Christian. Like, where can you go? There's nowhere to hide, you know. So I didn't do that. I've probably put more people off the Christian faith than won people to the Christian faith, but I was certainly very, very passionate. So I worked with the Salvos for, actually, all in all, 12 years. And then in 2000, big change in my life. I'll talk a little bit about one of those tomorrow. My wife and I set up 2 organizations. One is a non-profit organization that works in Africa with orphaned young people. I'll talk a bit about that tomorrow. And then I set up a business, which I've been running for the last 15 years. And so I've qualified as what's called a business psychologist, which is basically working in an organization to help people understand the interaction between the system, the organization, and people. And most of my time is spent trying to help leaders be better leaders. I call myself a performance coach, and I work in all sorts of organizations. And actually, partly why I'm here in this part of your world is to actually do some work here in Sydney, and then I've got to go to Singapore next week before the Brisbane conference. So that's what I do. I say I love Jesus, I love my family, and I really, really, really love rugby. Anyway, really do that. So we're going to be spending some time together over these next 2 days thinking about the concept of leadership. And not leadership of things, but leadership of self. Leadership of self. What it means to be, to lead me. I've spent a great deal of my life working with leaders who struggle to lead organizations. One of the reasons they struggle to lead organizations is because they struggle to lead themselves. And so we're going to be thinking about that whole idea, looking at all sorts of stories about what it means to be someone who actually leads themselves. Leadership of self. We're going to be thinking about that and what that means in the context of being a follower of Jesus. What it doesn't mean is to be someone who's perfect. Here's a quote I love from a man called Brennan Manning. What makes authentic Christians is not visions, ecstasies, biblical mastery of chapter and verses, or spectacular success in ministry, but a capacity for faithfulness, buffeted by the fickle winds of failure, battered by their own unruly emotions, and bruised by rejection and ridicule, authentic disciples may have stumbled and frequently fallen, yet they kept coming back to Jesus. That's a story of my life. That's a story of my life. One step forward, two steps forward. Two steps forward, three steps back. That's the story of my life. And what I would really like this weekend to be about is a real conversation. I've lost count of how many conferences I've spoken at. I cannot count how many Christian conferences I've spoken at over the last 25 years. Hundreds, literally. And what sometimes happens is this, that there's a guy or a girl up here, normally a guy, yeah, who kind of sits kind of 2 or 3 feet above contradiction, and then the sweaty mass out there kind of thing. And never the twain shall meet. And there's no real conversation, just I kind of speak at you. And if you're on the front row, sometimes spit at you, you know, on you. And then it's just the way it works. I'd like this weekend to be a different weekend. I'd like us to have a conversation together about what it means to be real. What it means to be a real bloke, doing his best to live the best he can, being the best with what he's been given in the real world. And I'm one of the people who actually thinks the best way to that, best route to that, is wrapping your life up in the story of Jesus. That's what I think. But I'd love us to have a conversation about that. Not just with me, but actually with each other. So we're going to start that. And while I'm talking and explaining what's going to happen, my faithful, beautiful assistants somewhere around the room are going to hand you all a piece of wire, okay? And I'm going to explain to you what this is about. So I'm going to invite you to have a conversation. And I'm going to ask you, I'm going to think back over the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, and think about your life, okay? And then do your kind of wire map. So here's mine, okay? Can you see my wire? Can you see it? Yeah, quite difficult. Those of you a little bit older, you're going, really, got a piece of wire? You know, put your glasses on. And James, put 2 pairs of glasses on. And so here's what I want you to do. I want you to have this kind of conversation with people in the room, okay? And so this is my life. So I'm going back about 10 years, okay? And I've been doing a job, and I started in 2000, started a new job down here somewhere. And it takes you a while to establish yourself in a new role and let go of your old role and let go of your old self and establish some things. So a few things started to happen, and established things, built business. Then a business that I'd started failed. And so we lost a lot of money on that business that failed and didn't go well. But then we built again, and it started to go really well. And then we had a kind of big financial crash. And we were quite lucky as a business that in that financial crash, we continued to grow rather than decline. Bizarre, I know. But that's this bit here going up. But then I'd been struggling with some stuff for some time. And in 2010, I hit a wall. I hit a wall, and I'll talk a bit more about that wall later on. But actually, what I suffered over a kind of an 18-month period is some mental health challenges. And to be honest, I didn't ever think that would happen to someone like me, but it did. And so that's this bit here. That's this bit here. I kind of fell off a cliff, physically, emotionally, mentally. I fell off a cliff and ended up in quite a difficult and dark place. And so I was in this place for some time, and that's this bit here. And then began to, and still a building then over these last few years, into a more positive and more healthy, certainly much, much healthier place, and find myself kind of healthier and humbled to be in this place. I'm very, very thankful for the life I'm privileged to live. And so this is where I find myself going now. So that's my story of the last 10 years. So to whatever extent you're able to do that and think about that, Pete and the band are going to play a bit of music to us. Spend a couple of minutes doing your version of the story. And then what I'd love you to do is I'm going to invite you to stand up and go and find a person that you don't know, you've never met before, and say, I'd like to tell you my story, and tell them your story. Let's make this not a conference, but a conversation with each other, shall we? And then we'll keep worshiping together, and we'll go on from there. Is that all right, gentlemen? Is that all right? Brilliant. Okay. Make a way, tell your story, then be upstanding, go find someone. And find someone standing. Don't try and sit down and do this. Go find someone. Okay? To you, but just a story you can tell. Thank you so much. That's mine.
That's yours.
That's my bubble. Okay, good. Thanks for that, you thieving tow rag. Anyway, that's the land of criminals, eh? Anyway, here we go. Here we go. Oh. What I've seen tonight, I've seen the secret of Aussie sporting success. I've learned something tonight. It's fantastic. It must be. Anyway, enough of that. I've been to lots of Christian conferences, as I said, and I think one of the best things to do is not to make any assumptions about who people are. The story is told about of a Baptist convention. The Southern Baptists are very, very serious people in America. And they speak quite funny with Southern Baptists. And at this big particular conference, there's a couple of thousand people in this auditorium. And a guy welcomes everyone, and you know, every denomination has their version. I mean, this was the Baptist version of it. And he says, "It's great to be here tonight. Welcome." He went, "Ah," a couple of thousand people. Just. He said, "We think God's a great God." Went, "Ah." He said, "We're all thrilled to be Baptists." He went, "Yeah." I said, "Are we all Baptists?" And everyone went, "Yeah." And a little old lady on the front row said, "No, I'm not." And like everyone heard this and said, "Well, what's going on?" He said, "Madam," he said, "why aren't you a Baptist?" She said, "I'm a Salvation Army person." And he looked down at her and everyone went quiet, a couple of thousand people. He said, "Madam," he said, "why are you a Salvation Army person?" She said, "My great-grandfather was Salvation Army. My grandfather was Salvation Army. My father was Salvation Army. So I'm Salvation Army." He said, "Madam, that's ridiculous." He said, "If your great-grandfather was a moron, your grandfather was a moron, your father a moron, would not that make you a moron?" She said, "No," she said, "if my great-grandfather was a moron, my grandfather a moron, and my father a moron, I'd have been a Baptist." Anyway. Yeah, I just lost my voice, actually, trying to do that. Note to self, don't try and do high-pitched voices. Anyway, so, I don't want to make any assumptions, and it's really interesting in our society today. The assumption we make about what it means to be a bloke. Now, I actually feel quite sorry for my son and his generation, because it's really quite confusing, I think things have changed. When I listen to my father's dead now, and I will listen to him sometimes talk about what it was like when he was young and everything. And life was just so much more simple. Blokes were blokes, girls were girls, blokes had their jobs, girls had, and it was much more simple. Well, it just appears so much more complex these days. And so what we don't want to do is to make any assumptions, because I think the story of what it means to be a bloke in the 21st century is a story yet to be written. I think we're still learning what that means in this day and age. Some blokes say, "Oh, it goes back to being like, you know, be like this Neanderthal from about 1,000 years ago." Pretty sure it doesn't mean that. Nor does it mean becoming just the same as what it means to be a woman, but with hair or armpits and stuff. You know, it certainly doesn't mean that. But I think in this day and age, one of the really interesting questions is, well, what's it really mean to be a bloke? What's that really mean? And it seems to me a really important part of that question is this issue of, well, it means to be someone who has kind of mastery and leadership of themselves. Whatever it might look like, however it might express itself, it will absolutely mean to be a bloke, to be a good bloke, means to be someone who's got kind of leadership mastery of themselves, whatever that's going to look like. Because I think we live in an age where it's quite difficult to be too certain about how that's going to work out and what that's going to look like. But I think there are some things that we can build on, and there are some things we can think about. And one of the most important questions that actually begins that journey is the question of, well, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are as a bloke? Who are you becoming as a bloke? Where have you come from as a bloke? I want you to look at the screen, left and right. And that particular question has been popularized quite recently on television. Please look at the screens, left and right. Thanks, guys. It's a really interesting program. Has anyone watched that program? Really interesting program. Really interesting. There's a woman in the UK. She's retired now, but she was a black woman. She's a very famous newscaster. And she went on this program, and she found out, it was the most amazing piece of drama I've ever seen. She found out that in her family's background, her great-great-great-grandfather was white, and he raped a slave on a plantation, and, you know, generations on, that was her. And it was just really, really powerful. She began to understand her story and where she'd come from, and began to see it in completely different lights. Well, our stories, gentlemen, aren't fixed. They're moving things. They're dynamic things. And I want us to explore a story tonight, which was told quite a few thousand years ago, just about 2,000 years ago. Now, again, I don't want to make any assumptions. So some of you here, I know, you go to church really regularly, all right? And others of you may not do. So if I say anything that doesn't make sense, come and grab me. If I use language which doesn't kind of like, what does that mean? Just come and grab me. Let's have a conversation about it. But there's a number of assumptions I am going to be making. And one of the assumptions is this, that actually there is a God in heaven, and that God is present in our lives and at work in our lives. Whether we know that, whether we acknowledge that, isn't the point. If there is a God in heaven that created the universe for a reason and a purpose, then it's really important we discover what that purpose is and give ourselves and our lives to it. So we're going to think a little bit about that. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about what it says about that God in the Bible and on what that book says about how it is that we should live and what it is that we should do. So I'm going to tell tonight, and we're going to look tonight at one of the most famous stories of the Bible. Can I come back to my thing now, please? Thank you. Which is the story often called the prodigal son. Hand in the air if you've heard the story of the prodigal son. Okay. And it's one of the most important parables that Jesus told. Jesus lived around about 2,000 years ago, and his story is told really classically in four books. They're called the Gospels. These are basically the biographies of Jesus, written by people who knew him and were around him when he was around on earth around about 2,000 years ago. So we're going to look at this story, and it's from the parable. And this is a very famous painting by Rembrandt, and I've actually seen this painting. It's extraordinary. It's in the Hermitage Center in St. Petersburg, or what used to be Leningrad. And it's an extraordinary story. And Rembrandt, as a painter, is known for a number of things. And if you look at the picture, you see it. He's known for light and how light is used. You never see the light, but you see the reflection of the light. So you see the kind of front left-hand side of everything, and the father's faith and the son kneeling before his father. You know, that's obviously coming from candles, from lights, and it lights things up. It's amazing. There's another picture of his called the Pietà, which is when Christ is being brought down from the cross. And I've stood in front of that picture, that painting, for about 20 minutes. It's extraordinary. And I swear you can almost feel the heat from the lamp that you can't quite see, but it's throwing up all this light. It's an extraordinary painting. And in this painting, we see some things. So just two things. For example, on the left-hand side, we see the father and the kneeling, repenting son. And on the right, we see the pious, religious, and very frustrated and cynical brother. But if you actually look closer, the left hand of the father is a big hand. It's a father's hand. The hand on the right is a woman's hand. And what he's not saying is he's some kind of zombie. What he's saying is, in this father expresses that perfect balance of masculinity and femininity and this kind of parental love towards the kind of returning son. It's an extraordinary photograph. Just have a look at it online. Just have a look. It's an amazing picture painted by Rembrandt. And this he calls the story of the prodigal son. So I'd like us to hear this story. And John's going to come and read this story to us. And we're going to look at this story in a bit more detail. Away you go, sir.
I want to encourage you that this is not a secret knowledge that only leaders can have. have, but it's something that each and every person has. So if you've got a Bible, you might want to open it up to Luke 15, or you might like to listen to it. If you don't have a Bible, come and see one of us and we'll grab one for you.
This is called the Parable of the Lost Son. Luke 15, starting at verse 11. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had and set off to a distant country and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he'd spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods of the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against you and against heaven. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all of these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. You never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Thank you. So this is a story. This is a story of a pretty dysfunctional family. I don't know what your family's like. I don't know what your family's like. My immediate family was reasonably functional. My extended family, just going back one generation, was a train wreck. It was an absolute train wreck. We're living with all sorts of broken relationships and broken promises and damaged people and suicides and abuse and violence and drugs and alcohol. It was just a train wreck, our family. Until in my parents' lives, Jesus met them and the whole thing transformed and changed. But it was a bit of a mess. So we all come from families, and families are messy. And so Jesus, when he tells this story, he's telling a story about a messy family riven with greed and ambition and fear and uncertainty and bitterness and resentment, all sorts of stuff. Pretty much like lots of our families. Okay? So Jesus is telling this as a parable. Oops. Let me just explain what a parable is. Some people have said the parables, or Jesus used parables to kind of make a point, a particular point about something. It's a story he made up. It's not a real story. It's a story he made up. But it wasn't to make a particular point. And basically what Jesus does when he tells parables is basically he says, hey, here's the world as you see it. It's your normal world. But as I tell you this parable, here's this new reality. Here's this new way of seeing the world. And I want you to see if you can find yourself in this new reality. Because living my way and living within my kingdom, it's like this. So he's not just making a point. That's not what parables were. Parables were real stories about real situations. Jesus is saying, here is this new reality. Here's a whole new way of thinking about life. See if you can find yourself within it. Let's just reflect on this parable, this story. This is going to give it a bit more color. Secondly, it wasn't just the father's money. In those days, when someone was rich and wealthy, it actually included hundreds of people. Chances are this was a rich nobleman, you know, that lived in a house at the center of a community. In many of our urban centers these days, the wealth is in the suburbs. But actually in those days, it was completely different. That actually the poor lived in the kind of outlying fields, and all the wealth was centered around the kind of big mansion in the middle. But actually, when, for example, wealth was stripped or wealth was taken away, it didn't just affect the family in the middle. It affected the hundreds of people within that community. So the decision this young guy is going to make is going to affect not just his father and his brother, but hundreds of people within the community when half of the wealth is taken from them. First thing, it's important that we understand that. Second is this. Basically, what the son is doing is saying to his dad, drop dead. See, there wasn't really a context in society in those days to take your inheritance early. The only point at which you got your inheritance was when actually your father died. And so to the original hearers, and as we when we read the Bible, it's always best to say, what did this mean to the people that heard it first? What did it mean to them? And when people heard that, they would have thought, "That what a disgusting young man. What a scandalous thing to do, to demand from your father your kind of part of the estate. What a horrendous thing to do." So they would have been scandalized by the story. And actually, they wouldn't have blamed the father for killing his son, because wrapped up in the idea of saying, I want now what I would normally only get when you're dead is an implied threat. Well, of course, if you don't give me, then maybe I should actually bring forward that event so I can actually get what I want. So the people listening to the story wouldn't have had any problem if what the father had done was actually just turn around and just got, you know, put the kid in prison or actually dealt with the kid really severely and killed. And that would have been entirely acceptable. And then what happens is the father says to his son, okay, if that's what you want to do, and he allows him to have half the estate. And Jews, within Jewish law, a Jew couldn't sell property to a Gentile. But the story is told this guy that goes away and sells the estate, sells it quickly, and actually makes this money. And so it was utterly scandalized. And so what probably would have happened in that day and that age is that the local community, having had all this wealth ripped out of their community, would have had some kind of ceremony to cut this guy off forever from that community, to symbolize the fact that he betrayed everybody in the community because he ripped half the wealth and half the food and half of the resource out of that community of a couple of hundred people at least. And so the kid's basically saying to his dad, Dad, this is how I feel about you. I'd like you to drop dead. And then, of course, he goes away and he lives scandalous. He lives a scandalous life. There's no suggestion, his brother says later on, that he slept with prostitutes or anything like that, but he went and wasted, and he squandered his money. He wasted half the money. And then he ends up in this situation where all the money's gone, and oh, wow, all his new friends have gone. They've all disappeared. And he ends up in a situation where he actually ends up caring for pigs, eating the pods that pigs would eat. Now, again, in this story, Jesus is saying something that would be very powerful to Jewish people. You know, pigs were really unclean animals to Jews. Still are today. They don't eat pork. They don't eat pork. Okay? And so to Jews saying, wow, he went, this is about as low as you get. You're sitting eating the food that pigs would eat. It's as low as you can get. And so all of the people who originally heard it were going, wow, this kid reaches the very pits of this state. It actually comes to a point. And where he actually says, and he actually used the word, he actually comes to his senses. So we have a kind of a fast-track, microwave version of this young man's life, raised in a opulent and quite privileged environment, comes to a point where he says, I just want to go do my own thing. I want to just go do my own thing. And so, guns off, asks his father, basically says to his dad, Dad, I don't care about you. I'd wish you were dead because I want half the estate, and goes away. And goes and sells his estate very, very quickly, probably because of the abuse he would have received from all the villagers that also lost half the wealth and resource in the community, and ends up in this desperate place. And then it says, he came to his senses. He came to his senses. He actually paused and he looked his life. He looked himself in the mirror and he says to himself, just think of my father's got loads of servants who eat far better than I do. What am I doing here? I'm going to go back. I'm going to say to him, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Please would you accept me back in and come as a hired hand back into your family environment. And so it says he comes to his senses. Now, I've had the privilege over the years of talking to lots and lots of people about life, about their life, about what happened in their life. And it has been a great privilege to talk with numbers of people over that time who had one of these catalytic moments whereby they came to their senses. And I want to tell you a story. It's a very real story, and it's a very live story about a friend of mine. One of the times I came to Australia, was in the early noughties. And I came to do some work here for a couple of weeks. And I brought with me a friend of mine. He was an ex-military guy, ex-special forces soldier, who came to help me to do some of the work I was doing here. This is not a man that ever goes to church. This is not a man that has any interest in religion or anything like that. We came to do some work together. But at the weekends, he came to a couple of conferences that my good friend here, Greg, was running called Unlimited. And he came and he went to a few of the sessions. He thought it was really interesting. He thought the music was really good, but really no interest in faith. And this man's life is a train wreck. He's now on his third marriage, if I recall correctly, and has got kids from the first. I mean, it's just his life is a bit of a mess. He would say his life is a bit of a mess. Anyway, about, was it 8 months ago, Greg? Where are you, Greg? 8 months ago? Yeah. My friend Greg here sends me a note about my friend Paul that I haven't spoken to for quite a long time. And Greg had had a dream that God had given him about my friend. So Greg writes to me, and if you want to see, I can show you the emails. And basically, he says, look, God gave me this dream about this guy that brought with you. You know that guy you brought with you that I met? God gave me this dream about this guy. And that this was his life. He was a little bit like Forrest Gump, who is running and running and running, and he's running in rags, and all his clothes are rags, and his life's in a really bad place, and he keeps running past all these signs, and the car signs that keep saying, stop running, stop running. But he just keeps running. Then he comes to a point where he collapses because he just can't run anymore. And what God wants to say to him is, stop running because I have a wonderful plan for your life. So Greg sends me this email that drops in my inbox out of the blue. He says, look, I don't know if you're still in touch with this guy, but I just feel I should tell you I had this dream. And if you think you should pass it on to him, do that. So what would you do? One of your mates, he doesn't go to church, never been to church, and your mate sends you an email that says that God's spoken to him about his life and about his future. What would you do? So I got on the phone, I said, hello, Paul, with me, a little chat. I said, Paul, I said, listen, mate, I said, I'm going to send you an email, and it might be a little bit strange, but I want you to read it, and I want you to think about it, and then I'll have to talk to you about it. So I send it to him. He rings me straight away, I mean, within 8 minutes, and he says, that's amazing. He said, that's amazing. He said, the bit about, you know, look, my life is like I'm running in rags and I'm running around. He said, absolutely. He said, that's a no-brainer. He said, you know, my life's a train wreck. He said, that's absolutely true. The thing I found most scary was when Greg said that when I eventually stopped, that I need to stop because God has a plan for my life. And I suddenly thought, what if that's true? So then we started having conversations about that. Okay? And so we've been here, and I've said, look, get in touch with Greg, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then my friend Paul sent me this email about six days ago. I want to read this to you. It says he's had this thing, and he's been thinking about this for a little while. He writes an email to myself and Greg. Dear both, if hindsight was a gift, I think I'd have missed unwrapping it. He thinks he's funny as well, but anyway, he's not, but... I find myself broken, not being able to run. I've ruptured my patella tendon below the kneecap, and after 3.5 hours of open knee surgery, I'm looking at 6 to 9 months to full fitness. Your vision, dream, or call it a premonition, has even more prominence now. I know there's a lesson in here somewhere, I'm not sure where. What I do know is that I truly have had to stop running. Which often leaves one pondering life and the universe. To double whammy it, I sent yours, in speech marks, Greg's, initially an email to a friend and mentor of mine a while ago for his open perspectives, and we chatted about it. His computer had to reinstall some software the other day. He spelled software wrong. And when it had finished, all his emails had disappeared. And suddenly, only one came back, yours. He stood back and stared at the screen as all the other 2,000-odd emails had gone, and only mine and yours had returned. He closed the laptop, reopened it, and everything was back to normal. and all the other emails back in their place. The reason? I can only speculate. The question for me now is, what has or does God have in line for me to do? What is my purpose? And if I do have a higher purpose, how do I explore that? I'll let you guys have a think on that little lot. Come back to me once you've pondered it. Until then, God bless. Your friend, Paul. Paul is slowly but surely coming to his senses. And in responding to the Father, to Father God. So the story carries on. And this is an amazing story. It says the father was in his house wanting and dreaming that one day his son might come back. And it says that when his son was still a long way off, he ran to him. He ran to him. Now we need to understand this. The reason he ran to him was twofold. Number one, he loved his boy. He loved his boy. And number two, he was fearing his boy's safety. See, for the boy to get to the father's house, which is at the center of the community, he had to walk through the gauntlet of all of these people who had lost half of the resource and half of the wealth. And what he feared most likely is that he would be stoned on the way in. So the father ran to the son and said, "Don't mess with my boy." Now, the man I was reading who understands the original culture and original context really well, because he spent most of his adult life in the Middle East, said this. He said, "To Western ears and eyes, you miss the power of the story. This now is the most offensive thing in the story so far. The idea of a nobleman running was completely, completely unheard of. A nobleman wouldn't run. He would walk around gracefully with his robes, you know, brushing around the floor and just take his time, because that's what a dignified nobleman would do. The idea of a nobleman lifting up his robes and running towards his son would have been utterly scandalous to those that heard it first time." He said it's like the cultural equivalent in the West of actually pulling up his robes and showing his ankles. He said in the Western world, it would be the equivalent of standing on a stage like this and dropping your trousers, which I'm not going to do, by the way. No visual illustrations. It would have been that offensive. But such is the father's love for his boy, such is concern for his returning son, he runs to him. And then the son starts to pull out the kind of, he's practiced his script of what he's going to say. Father, he starts to blurt this out, and the father will have none of it. He throws his arms around his boy, and he kisses him. How many of you have been kissed by your dad? Do you know, I remember when I was about 13 or 14, we just went to pick my friend up from on the way to school. And as he was leaving, his dad kissed him. And I remember thinking, because my dad didn't do that. My dad didn't do that. My dad really wasn't a kisser. Didn't do that intimacy thing, my dear old dad. And I remember thinking how weird it was. And I didn't really know my dad that well. I mean, he was my dad, but we didn't have what you would call an intimate relationship together as father and son. And something really strange happened when I was, he was 41 when I was born. So I'm now 37, okay? So that means he's 78. And something really quite strange happened. On one occasion, I was at my parents' house, and my little girl was teething. So it's like 3 o'clock in the morning, so I'm up doing the modern man thing and looking after the baby. And anyway, it's like 2 o'clock in the morning. And suddenly, my dad walks in his dressing gown and his slippers and 2 cups of tea. I said, "Right, Dad, what are you doing out of bed?" He said, I heard you were up with the baby, so I thought I'd come and keep you company. And they've made me a cup of tea. So like, I'm going, okay, I start to panic. I'm thinking, what's going on? What's weird? This is like really, really weird. Like, this has never happened ever before. You know? So I said, "Oh, that's really kind of you, Dad. But, you know, I'm going to put her in the car, and I'm going to try and drive her and get her to sleep if I can." So I just rushed past my dad, and I get in the car and drive her. Now, she's asleep within about 30 seconds. But I drive, there's docks near where my parents lived, and there's a kebab, kind of mobile kebab place there. So I'm sitting there at like 2 o'clock in the morning now, eating stuff in my kebab in my face, sitting thinking, this is ridiculous. For whatever reason, suddenly this old man, 78-year-old, wants to get intimate with his little boy, who's also 37, And like, I can't handle it. How pathetic are you? So I committed myself to go back and try and do something about that and try and respond positively to it. My resolve was to be tested. The next day, we were leaving. And normally, when I would say goodbye to each other, me and my dad, there was this kind of arm round each other's shoulder type thing, you know, where it wasn't really a hug. It was a kind of slap on the back to kind of, okay, I'm being pretty expressing some intimacy here, but it's not really interesting, so I'll give you a little slap on the back thing. And that's what we used to do. And we'd always side up to each other, and we'd both do that. And he was a big man, my dad. He's a big, big lad, you know. So we come around, we go, like this. And so I went to do that. As we're walking towards the stairs, I went, all right, Dad, nice to see you. Put my arm round. And he put his big left arm around me. And then he brought his big right arm round and bear hugged me. And for the first time in my life, kissed me on the cheek and said, love you, son. And what was that like? Age 37? Well, it was pretty tough. Because he has dentures and false teeth and he dribbles when he kissed me, and that was that was a bit rough. But also, he didn't live much longer after that. It was absolutely fantastic. As an old man, for whatever reason, began to think, I need to express my intimacy for my son. So I don't know why I told you that story. I wrote it down earlier to say it, but I just think I should. Because some of you are dads, and some of you are sons. And it might be that in your dad and son role, you need to come to your senses and do something about that lack of intimacy thing with you and your dad or your son or whatever. And I just want to say, it's never too late. It wasn't too late for a 78-year-old. Probably won't be too late to you. So the father, he runs to his boy and he kisses him. And again, people would have been outraged there. But what do you mean you kiss him? The kid should be on his knees begging for forgiveness and you might allow him to work for a while. And he said, no, 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 this is my son. This is absolutely fantastic. And so there starts this celebration. And what happens is he puts three things on him. Firstly, it says he puts a robe on him. Well, that speaks of the father's status, the father saying, this son is my son. He's my family. So this is the robe. I want you all to recognize and acknowledge that. Secondly, he gives him a ring. It would have been a signet ring. It was a ring of authority saying, when this man speaks, it's like I'm speaking. So that's how I want you to see him and I want you to treat him. And then he said he put sandals on his feet. You see, in those days, the only people that actually wore sandals were free men. Others couldn't afford them or didn't have them. Slaves didn't wear them. Only men who were free and not indebted to anyone, wore sandals. And the father was saying, this man has built up a debt, but the debt is cancelled, so I'm putting sandals for you, because he is a free, free man. The debt is paid, and I've paid it. And so begins this huge celebration. And he says, kill the fatted calf. It would have been a big animal. And so basically what the father's doing, he says, I'm putting on a party, boys and girls. And the reason I've run here is this is my boy. Don't mess with my boy because he's my boy. And that's why I've run all this way, because this is my boy. And he's home and it's just fantastic. Because the lost kid is found. So there's amazing celebration. But then back into the story comes the other brother. So on the one moment, there's celebration going on. And at the same time, there's a cynicism going on. And then what we have is this even more scandalous thing that takes place. Because although the younger son, when he'd gone away with the money and everything else, that had been really insulting to the father, but at least it was done in private. The older son now, in front of everybody, says, what on earth are you doing? I've slaved all these years. Calls himself a slave for some reason. I've slaved all these years, and you've never done anything for me. And the father says, son, he said, everything I have is yours. But my son was lost, but now he's been found. Can't you celebrate this with me? And then all of a sudden, the story ends. And we're left not knowing how the story ends. We don't know. Hollywood doesn't write the end of this story. The other brother doesn't go, you're right, Dad, it's wonderful. They embrace. Kylie Minogue starts to sing in the background. You know, it doesn't happen that way. It doesn't happen. There's no end to the story. There's no tidy ending. There's no mushy ending. It's just left with this fractured, broken relationship. And a huge question. Well, what will the other son do? And so here we have the story of these two young men. These two men. These two sons. And it's often in the Bible called the parable of the prodigal son. It's called the parable of the prodigal son because at the beginning, of course, it's a son who goes away and then returns. But it's also a story about the other son and about how he responds to his father's grace and his father's generosity. And how the story ends, we don't know. But maybe that's because our job is to find ourselves in that story and answer how that story might end. So at the beginning of this weekend, I wanted to ask you a question to reflect on this amazing story. And it's this question. So who do you think you are? Let me ask you a question. Which one of the sons do you most relate to? Is it the first son? Is it the son that's made all sorts of dumb and stupid decisions? And that you've squandered the life that God has given you? And you've gone off in your own way, in your own direction, and not made the most of what God's given you? And you see that aspect of yourself and you say, yeah, I can as the prodigal son, I can respond to the invitation of the Father. Or do you see yourself, you may relate more to the other guy, the other son, this bitter, resentful, religious, pious bloke who walks around with this kind of victim mentality somehow. You've never done anything for me, really? Everything I've got's yours, really? That he's bitter and he lives with constant disappointment with himself and his brother and his father's entire state in life. And so he walks around resentful in life, filled with the poison of resentment and bitterness and disappointment at the world and at his life and at his lot. And looks on others with harsh judgmentalism. And sometimes arrogance and a kind of air of superiority. Maybe you can relate to that one. Or maybe, like me, you can relate to them both. There's a very famous writer, very Christian leader. He was reading about this story once. He said he always saw himself, you know, more like the prodigal son returning. And someone said to him, well, actually, maybe you're more like the other one. And so he said this about himself. He said, can the eldest son in me come home? How can I return when I'm lost in resentment, when I'm caught in jealousy, when I'm imprisoned in obedience and duty, that is, lived out as slavery? I don't know most of you here in this room. I know quite a lot of you are wrapped up and involved with the Salvation Army. Maybe quite a number of you work for it. Maybe some of you are even officers in the Salvation Army. This paragraph's for you. When I'm caught in jealousy, when I'm imprisoned in obedience and duty, that is, lived out as slavery. And you see yourself as a victim. And that's the brother that you are. And the truth of the story is this. Who do you think you are? The answer is both of them. Because both the sons were lost. Both the sons were lost. In fact, the only difference between the first son and the second son is the first son realized and came to his senses that he was lost. Whereas we have no evidence in the story that the second son ever realized that. But they're both lost. And it's really unhelpful that in the Bible it calls it the story of the prodigal son. Because actually the story really isn't about the first son or the second son. The story is much, much more about the loving father. The loving father who faced humiliation and shame and lifted his robe up. And ran towards his boy and hugged him and kissed him and said, welcome home, son. Welcome home. And both sons were lost. And both sons were invited back in to come home. And as the story ended, only one accepted. But they were both lost. And the story is really more and more about the father and his love. And his grace, and his invitation to come home. And one of the things I said to my friend Paul on the phone was this. I told him a story about a man called John Chipman. He's one of the early church founding fathers. And he said this about the God of the Bible. He said, we worship a God who is constantly lapping at the shores of people's lives. Lapping at the shores of people's lives. And I said to my friend Paul, I said, Paul, maybe. I said, this story, this stream from Greg, these things that are happening in your life, that's just God saying, Paul, come home. Come home. Come home. Because that's the invitation of the Father to his boys, and that's the invitation to you and I. And so I want to tell you one more story before I finish and hand it back over to the band who are going to lead us in some worship together. But I wanted to put that out there for you to think about tonight. And as we worship together in a few moments' time, you may want to spend a few moments and just come forward and kneel here and pray. Whichever the sons you best relate to, whichever of their life you see to yourself, the truth is they're both lost. And in this room, there aren't people that are the sorted ones and the people that aren't sorted ones. There aren't people who are the found ones and the unfound ones. We're all lost. And we're all receiving an invitation by the Father to come home and get to know our God, our Father, even more intimate ways. And so you may want to, as we worship together, come and kneel and just pray and say, okay, I want to say thank you. I want to come home. I want to come home to a deeper place, to a more intimate place, or to a new place. But what I want to do over this weekend is really, really come home. I want to tell you a story about a young man. It's an unremarkable story. It's a pretty bland story, but let me tell you anyway. So a young man grew up in a kind of an average kind of home. Nothing spectacular about it. Wasn't particularly spectacular. Wasn't particularly bad. Just a normal kind of environment. And he was a middle child. And he had two sisters. And he was a bit insecure. And wasn't really very good at anything. And got bullied quite a lot when he was at school. And you know, that led to really low self-esteem. When this young man was in his mid-teens, he considered suicide very seriously on two occasions. Such was the low self-esteem that comes to people who have been bullied so horrendously. And this, when this young man was 16 years of age, he discovered he was good at a sport. He'd never been any good at any sport, but he discovered he was good at one sport. And that was the sport of boxing. And he discovered he was better than most of the people in his local area. And so as he started to kind of gain success and was taken around to different places, he discovered that he was better than most of the people in the wider area. And then as he got better in the coming years, he discovered he was better than the people all over the country in that particular area, in his particular weight class. And so his entire life became wrapped up in this boxing thing. And everything became about that. And his entire identity was wrapped up in this is who I am, this is me, I'm this boxer guy. And everything was wrapped up in that. But it was no different from the insecure little boy that had been at school and had been bullied at school and was uncertain, didn't know who he was, and just thought he'd spend his life trying to please others by telling jokes or being funny. And basically, he was just still that very, very insecure little boy. And then when that young man was 19 years of age, someone told him a story. Someone told him an amazing story that he probably heard as a younger boy, but he hadn't really listened to. Someone told him this story, that actually there's a God in heaven that created him for an amazing purpose in life. And that despite all of his sin, and despite all of his weakness, and despite all of his inadequacy, and despite all of his failure, and despite all of his weakness, God wanted to take his life and use his life for great things because God had a purpose and a destiny in mind when he allowed him and created him and made him to be born. And that actually, despite his sin and his weakness, that same God had then come down in the person of Jesus, who had then given his life so that that young man would never have to carry the can for his own sin and his own mistakes, the ones that he'd made and all the ones he ever would make, because that price had already been paid. And then that same God had risen from the dead to show he was not just the power of life, but also had the power of death, and invited him to follow him. And that young man, when he heard that story, began a whole new journey of life in responding to the invitation that God made to him, which was to come home. Now, there's no big ending to that story, because the story is just going on. There's nothing particularly profound about that story, unless that story is your story. The story I just told you is my story. That's my story. As an insecure young guy, I discovered at age 16 I was good at one thing, hitting people. Not the best thing in life to be good at, I accept. But I was quite good at that. But I was still that frightened little boy. I was still that frightened little boy. And then somebody was kind enough one day to tell me about a loving God who had given me life and had offered me an invitation to come home, to come home, to come home. And all I said was, thank you. I'm not home yet. I'm still coming home. I'm still on that journey. But it's a journey I've chosen. It's a journey I've been gifted by him. And it's the best, best journey of all. So that's my story. What's your story? What choices will you make? Maybe some important ones in the few hours we're going to have together this weekend. Let's stand, shall we? We're going to worship God together. I'm going to pray. And then as the band lead us in worship, if you want to acknowledge your lostness, if you want to come and kneel and pray and say, okay, God, I want to respond to the call you made to. I want to respond to that call to come home. I want to put myself in that place where you can do in my life all that you want to do, anything that you want to do, then feel free to come and kneel and make that commitment to God tonight, if that's what you'd like to do. No matter who you are, no matter where you are, no matter which son you see yourself most relevant to, if you want to come home, now I invite you to come and kneel and pray and make that commitment to God this night about what these next few days are going to be like and about for you.